Well, welcome to the Leonard Shapiro Government and Opposition Lecture. Government and Opposition was established over 30 years ago now as an independent journal of comparative politics by a group of scholars, most of them at that time at the LSE, led by Gita Ionescu, and including that great LSE student of the Soviet Union, Leonard Shapiro. After Leonard's death, this series of annual lectures was named after him, and they are published, the full text are published in the journal. Today we're very pleased to add to our list of distinguished speakers Professor Peter Hennessy, Professor of Contemporary History at Queen Mary and Westfield College. Peter Hennessy was for over 20 years a journalist, mainly on the Times, and he was the most academic of journalists and has since been perhaps the most investigative of academics. As a journalist, he pioneered the reporting of Whitehall rather than Westminster. And in both his capacities, he has made a specialism of uncovering layers of governance which have lain hidden hitherto. Books and articles on, amongst others, the British establishment, on government news management, and on the operations of the cabinet, particularly revealing the details of its committee system. He's now working on a book on the job of the Prime Minister since the war, and today he will speak on a subject which he offered to us before the election, the Blair style of government, an historical perspective, and an interim audit. Peter.
Thank you very much, Geraint. It's a tremendous honour to be asked to lecture in the name of Leonard Shapiro, who was a great figure at the school here when I was a postgraduate student a quarter of a century ago. May I begin, ladies and gentlemen, this evening with a dash of historical perspective. I do so as a health warning, to myself as much as to anyone else. Just as the great Lord Salisbury once said that too much poring over maps tended to drive 19th century ministers and military chiefs mad, an excessive concentration on prime ministerial styles can propel scholars and commentators smack bang into the Tommy Cooper school of analysis. Here you have collective government. Then just like that, when the premiership changes hands, you switch to overbearing prime ministerial government. And there has been a good deal of this since Tony Blair entered number 10 exactly 214 days ago. We have been here before many times, and not just in the 35 years since the John McIntosh, Dick Crospin thesis about the demise of cabinet government took off in 1962, much to the disdain of the historically minded Harold Macmillan, who was filling the premiership at the time. Take the Cabinet Secretariat's so-called magnum opus file, which can be read at the Public Record Office. It is undated and anonymous, but unmistakably a product of the early 1920s, when the great command premier of the 20th century, David Lloyd George, was allegedly wrecking the proper collective nature of cabinet government by carrying over his and Maurice Hankey's invention, the Cabinet Office, inappropriately into the piece. The document contains a very significant passage from Austen Chamberlain. Speaking as Lord Privy Seal from the coalition government front bench in the House of Commons in 1922, Chamberlain recalled that drollest and most intellectually astringent of premiers, A.J. Balfour, as telling him that he'd never known a prime minister who was not accused either of being a mere cipher or tool in the hands of some stronger colleague or a tyrant who dominated over the cabinet. If I can imitate AJB for a moment, there is a cycle to these things. We're examining a shifting governmental scene, a rolling performance, not a series of clear-cut changes resulting in permanent alterations to practice, procedure, and convention. Cabinet government, one might almost say, has had more comebacks than the late Judy Garland. The day I took up my pen to draft this lecture, Peter Riddle, the most accomplished provider of an almost daily recitative on the inner workings of British central government, devoted his column in the Times to the claim, as his opening sentence put it, that the long-predicted demise of the cabinet as a central organ of government has finally occurred. Under Tony Blair, the full cabinet has lost even its residual role as a court of appeal or as a forum for discussing big issues. He went on to quote the cabinet secretary, Sir Robin Butler, to the effect that the cabinet has returned to its 18th century origins as a weekly meeting of political friends. That's the cabinet secretary's words for it now. A weekly meeting of political friends who discussed issues informally, the real decisions being taken elsewhere. Like Peter Riddle and Robin Butler, I've been following developments, not merely since the 2nd of May, but anticipating them, or trying to. For Tony Blair and his people had been quite candid during the months before the election about the style of government to be adopted if the electorate gave them their chance. Mr. Blair didn't quite imitate Margaret Thatcher, whose approach he admired and whose counsel he so much enjoyed when he invited her to call shortly after entering Number 10. Famously, she told Kenneth Harris of The Observer, 3 months before assuming the premiership in May 1979, that it must be a conviction government. As Prime Minister, I could not waste time having any internal arguments. The nearest we had from Mr. Blair was a sentence in his speech at the Newspaper Society in March 1997, in which he declared, "People have to know that we will run from the centre and govern from the centre." But those closest to him, in pre-election briefings for businessmen as well as civil servants, were even more explicit about what they called the drive from the centre. As one of them put it, "You may see a change from a feudal system of barons to a more Napoleonic system." A feudal system of barons to a more Napoleonic system. And this was the most graphic, private and authoritative exposition of the Blair style to come that I encountered in the weeks before the general election. Now, the significance of such remarks is that they demonstrate that a Napoleonic style of premiership was planned for whatever the size of the majority Labour might accrue. As a traditionalist, ladies and gentlemen, on such matters, for reasons I shall explain in a moment, I was sufficiently alarmed to pen a warning in the Financial Times on the 26th of March this year. "Command premierships of a highly personalised and driven kind," I solemnly intone, for I can be formidably pompous when I have to be. "Command premierships of a highly personalised and driven kind usually end in tears. Sir Anthony Eden's and Mrs. Thatcher's did in 1957 and 1990 respectively. Getting your own way simply by stamping the prime ministerial foot is conducive neither to good government, nor to personal survival, nor to a contented retirement." A month later, during a BBC Radio 4 analysis discussion with William Hague and Donald Dewar, among others, I stuck my neck out even further and said, "You have a commanding figure in Mr. Blair. It's going to be a command premiership. I just hope there's a bit of freedom of information and democracy in the cabinet." Now, was I right to be so concerned? Has it worked out that way? And if it has, is it no bad thing? Hasn't it made for effective government? For as a very senior Whitehall figure put it a few weeks after the transition and shortly after Lady Thatcher's call on Mr. Blair, Mrs. Thatcher's way of running cabinet was effective but not democratic. Now, I must emphasise, ladies and gentlemen, as indeed it's in my title, that this is an interim audit. It is still early days. As Peter Riddle rightly stressed at the end of his Demise of Cabinet Government article last month, collective responsibility depends on senior ministers being able to have their say on big issues. Mr. Blair can command now, but he will need to involve his cabinet before long. What I shall do this evening, therefore, is to describe the unfolding style of new Labour government as it has appeared to me at various stages in the life of the Blair administration since the 2nd of May. Now, the 7 days spanned by the 2nd to the 9th of May are where we have to start, and not just with the now legendary hitting the ground running of Tony Blair and his team in Number 10, or the new Prime Minister's pledge to the Cabinet Secretary's regular Wednesday morning meeting of his fellow Permanent Secretaries on the 7th of May, that his government would be driven by ethics, not ideology. We need to examine, too, the other three members of the Big Four, as they're known in Whitehall, Gordon Brown at the Treasury, Robin Cook at the Foreign Office, and John Prescott at Environment and Transport and Regions. For each in their own way was as pertinacious as any tomcat in marking out their territory during those first few hours. Thanks to the STV documentary, the Brown team's dash for dominance at the Treasury has been preserved for posterity. Out of the shadows, was a gripping programme, both in policy terms, the shift of interest rate setting to the Bank of England and its new monetary committee, the shift of other bank functions, both of the Treasury and to a new super SIB, the Treasury's dominant role in the new Trans-Whitehall comprehensive expenditure reviews, and it was also revealing in people terms. The career Treasury as a whole, and not just its unfortunate head of information, were to experience policy making by inner cabal to a degree which hugely outstripped Jim Callaghan's use of Nicky Caldor and Robert Neill, for example, on Labour's arrival in 1964. Robin Cook, by contrast, established a quick and intelligent rapport with the Foreign Office machine. Cook also made sure, to the relief of the reform-minded, that he had a seat on all the constitutional cabinet committees which counted. John Prescott, Labour's deputy leader, got the super ministry he'd been seeking, despite doubts on the part of some of Blair's people and the civil service, who retained a scepticism of overlords passed from Whitehall generation to generation since Churchill's experiment with them in the early 1950s. Environment and transport were brigaded to meet the needs of the great hyper-minister, as one of his colleagues put it. Though the presence of a second cabinet minister, and one representing transport rather than environment at that, was regarded as inherently unstable by old Whitehall pros, and it will probably prove to be so. It's important, I think, not to underestimate the Prescott factor. It's not generally appreciated, for example, that he has a half hour alone with the Prime Minister before every cabinet meeting. He may not be a natural when it comes to being the chief executive of a jumbo ministry brimming with administrative detail, but his political touch as a minister is powerful, direct, and felt. It's important, too, to keep the Big Four in mind generally. It was significant that they, and only they, were in the cabinet ministerial loop, which knew in advance that interest rates were to move from Great George Street to Threadneedle Street. The full cabinet hadn't even met for the first time when the announcement was made. And the Big Four continue to meet once a week on Monday mornings, if they're not abroad, with no civil servants present. For those tempted to hail the existence of a Blair presidency, and President Blair is how Derek Draper entitled Chapter 1 of his insider account of Blair's 100 days, it is important to remember that this inner ministerial penumbra exists around the Prime Minister, which contains people, and here, ladies and gentlemen, there is a continuity between old and new Labour. This group contains people who are substantial figures in their own right and who do not fully appreciate the beauties of each other's personalities or the virtues of their approaches to policy making. Looking back to those early days in May, there is another big figure who must be included, though slightly apart from the Brown-Prescott-Cook trio, because he owes his substantial reach to Tony Blair's patronage rather than to his place in the Labour Party, or what I still rather quaintly like to call the Labour movement. It is not Peter Mandelson, who I'll come to in a moment, but Derry Irvine, the Woolsey of our day, as we discover, the Lord Chancellor. In the very first hours of the administration, he impressed himself upon the Cabinet Office as the figure who enjoyed the special confidence of the Prime Minister, whose pupil master he had been in Mr. Blair's fledgling legal days, and as the Lord Chancellor who, like no other in modern times, F.E. Smith and Quintin Hailsham included, would place his stamp on the conduct of central government. This he continues to do as chairman of the QFL, Queen's Speeches and Future Legislation Cabinet Committee, which rations parliamentary time among fiercely competing ministers, and as, in effect, overlord of the huge, important, unprecedented, and genuinely path-breaking process of constitutional reform across a wide field, which has been underway since May. The Prime Minister chairs CRP, which is the Constitutional Reform Policy Cabinet Committee, which meets to review the overall process. But it is Lord Irvine who runs the constellation of committees beneath it. Here, and perhaps here alone, we see the traditional infrastructure of collective government, the cabinet committee structure, in full operation. Though the Home and Social Affairs Committee, which John Prescott chairs, seems to be chugging along much as that committee has always done since 1918. Collective it may be, but the spirit in the Irvine committees is far from collegial. The fame of Lord Irvine's inquisitorial style in committee quickly spread across Whitehall, and he became notorious almost for outstripping even Mrs. Thatcher's capacity for interrupting ministers she found unsatisfactory. The Lord Chancellor managed to interrupt one hapless colleague during his first sentence. The Irvine swathe of committees have again uniquely seen a flourishing of that other traditional indicator of collectivity, paper. His DSWR Committee, Devolution to Scotland, Wales and the English Regions, received no less than 43 papers during the first 6 months of its existence. The degree to which the Irvine sector has operated as a distinct Cabinet Office entity has been widely noticed within Whitehall. In the early days, senior departmental officials, when contacting the Cabinet Secretariat about non-constitutional matters, which under previous governments, including Mrs. Thatcher's, would have gone to one or other of the Cabinet Standing Committees, were somewhat taken aback to be told that there was a different line on this. The drill now was for the departmental official to tell his or her Secretary of State that the practice was to take it up with Number 10, as the Prime Minister preferred to handle issues on an individual basis with senior ministers. Which brings us, ladies and gentlemen, to the alleged Blair presidency. Such is the new climate of openness that the Cabinet Office itself hosted an Economic and Social Research Council seminar in September, to which the ubiquitous Peter Riddle delivered a keynote speech, and he opened thus: "The Blair presidency. I can already hear veterans of the academic debate over the premiership tut-tutting over such journalistic laxity and ignorance." Now, I never have, ladies and gentlemen, and never will tut-tut at my friend Peter Riddle. But as a participant in, if not a veteran of, that old debate about prime ministerial versus cabinet government, I would add the word alleged before the phrase the Blair presidency. That phrase, Peter Riddle continued, is never uttered publicly by any of the Blair inner circle, but it is often used by them privately. This is not just a matter of style. There has also been a deliberate attempt to change the way Downing Street and the Cabinet Office work to allow the Prime Minister to exercise more control over the Whitehall machine. This has not occurred out of the blue. Mr. Blair's close advisers have studied the debate over the size and scope of the Prime Minister's office, which has developed since the 1960s. Hence, the decision to go for a Napoleonic rather than a feudal solution. Let us examine the Blair model as it has played out so far. We must begin with the full cabinet itself. Even though, as Lord Wakeham made public, the full cabinet was largely a reporting and reviewing body rather than a decision taker under John Major, Major did use it as his none too successful instrument for trying to bind his colleagues to a collective line on Europe. And as John Wakeham stressed, Major sought to use the cabinet apparatus as a whole, its standing committees especially, as a way of building consensus, the exact word Wakeham used, through full discussion and shared policy making. In a Blair equivalent of Wakeham's lecture on the Major style, Peter Mandelson, the Minister without portfolio, declared in September that the cabinet was not now the cook and the cabinet room is not the kitchen. To be fair to Mr. Mandelson, he used that phrase in his Birmingham University speech as part of a historical survey of cabinet government over the past 80 years, explaining that since 1916, most of the baking has been done in cabinet committees, which has relieved the pressure on cabinet. He went on, however, to stress the importance of the new ways of working, which have been introduced since May, to assist Blair in his ultimate responsibility for the strategic direction of his government. Proactive initiatives from the centre was the phrase. The closer relationship between the Number 10 policy unit and the Cabinet Office, the task forces, and the constant awareness, as Mandelson put it, of a bit of advice offered to us from President Clinton's early period in office. Keep describing the big picture. To govern is to choose, but to govern is also to communicate. We have built this into the policy-making process, he said. But before we get carried away by the dazzle and the rush of the Mandelson picture of new Labour in power, we must pause on the full cabinet, because here, perhaps, we see the phenomenon of proactive communication at its most bizarre. Cabinets are now extraordinary affairs, and not just because of their brevity. A 30-minute one just before the summer recess may have been the post-war record for a full dress as opposed to an emergency meeting. Certainly no one operational in Whitehall can remember a shorter one. And they rarely last more than an hour. There's no proper agenda in the formal sense of an item-by-item discussion. From the preparations for the famous Call Me Tony first meeting of the 8th of May, where Mr. Blair opened by saying, "It won't worry me if we use first names," the Prime Minister made it plain to the Cabinet Secretariat that he was not prepared to take a formal agenda, which had been the norm since Lloyd George and Hankey invented the Cabinet Office in 1916. There are headings, but Mr. Blair doesn't necessarily follow the order in which they appear. The note-takers follow the discourse wherever it goes and write it up as best they can. Some ministers outside the Cabinet, tell me that they find the minutes amongst the least important parts of their weekly reading. Now, this singular use of cabinet and the urban area apart, the relatively perfunctory and skimpy use of the more important standing cabinet committees, and even the relative disuse of the alternative mechanism of using correspondence to clear agreed positions, is what has led a variety of sophisticated and experienced Whitehall insiders to declare the death of traditional cabinet government. One put it boldly last month, this is not a collective government. We have to accept that the old model of cabinet government is as dead as a doornail. Another, speaking privately in October, just as the non-attributable spinners spun the financial markets into a tizzy about the Chancellor's position on the timing of the UK's possible membership of the single currency, produced a very well-judged interim portrait of the wider picture. This Prime Minister, he said, has killed off cabinet government very effectively. The question is, how long can he continue taking decisions with a very narrow core and then spinning it? The difficulty will come when they face hard choices and a cabinet minister who simply won't put up with it not being discussed in a cabinet committee or full cabinet. Now, this very senior insider was genuinely admiring of the productive, inquiring side of the Blair style, however. He didn't come anywhere near one of his distinguished and still well-connected predecessors, who told me around the same time of the delight he took in being told by his Whitehall friends of how Tony Blair makes Margaret Thatcher look like a natural consulter. The government, this particular old sweat went on, is living on a planet of its own and will continue to do so until something happens. And imitating the late Edith Evans playing Lady Bracknell, he said, to be a minister outside the inner loop is hell, to be a civil servant is impossible. The Treasury in particular is having a terrible time, he said. Now, the current insider, not a Treasury man, it has to be said, did see the benefits as well as the costs of the Blair approach to government. What is good, he said, is their determination to think long term and to get it right. The thought police have entirely gone. We can now think properly about policy in a European context, which is very refreshing. It's all gone extremely well so far, but we'll only see what they are capable of when something goes wrong. And it very swiftly did go wrong. Within days, the euro question had shaken both the Chancellor of the Exchequer and the Prime Minister, and even that husk of a residual, the full cabinet, was apprised of the market-soothing line on Britain and the single currency before Gordon Brown delivered it in the House of Commons. But what about that refreshing new approach to policy, including the long term? Here is where the new central configuration of Number 10 and the more proactive Cabinet Office, which Labour planned for in opposition, and which was pretty fully spelt out in advance in Peter Mandelson's and Roger Liddell's The Blair Revolution. This is where it's come into play, as have the battery of task forces. Now, there are at least 10 times more of these than Whitehall and well-placed observers had been expecting. There's been a profusion. Now, the plan, as I heard it before the election, put with great clarity, was for a stronger Number 10, which, through an enhanced Downing Street policy unit, working closely with a more proactive Cabinet Office, which would act as a Whitehall whip, altogether this would drive the machine as a whole, especially on those key pledges, such as welfare to work and education, that lay at the heart of Labour's appeal to the electorate. This is the key focus, the buckle joining the centre to the Whitehall periphery of Peter Mandelson's operation as the Prime Minister's keeper of the strategy, located in the Cabinet Office, with a seat on nearly all the Cabinet groups that count, though not yet in the full Cabinet itself. Now, the press, I think, ladies and gentlemen, may have overdosed on Mandelsonia, but he is, and has been from the beginning, a pivotal figure in the new style of government, in whose early shaping he also played a crucial part. Equally important is the way in which Mandelson and Jonathan Powell, the Prime Minister's Chief of Staff, who very sensibly did not become the Number 10 Principal Private Secretary as well, on Alex Allen's departure for the High Commissionership in Australia, it's the way Mandelson and Powell have tackled the problem which they both identified in opposition. That of handling the wicked issues which fell between the cracks of a vertically structured constellation of Whitehall departments. Wicked issues, by the way, is a phrase minted by Michael Bichard, Permanent Secretary at the Department for Education and Employment, which has appealed to Mr. Mandelson for some time. And here we can see the real variable geometry approach, which is, alongside the lack of collegiality, the hallmark of the Blair style. Given its variable nature, of course, it takes several forms. In one central, crucial area, It is the very special axis between number 10 and number 11 Downing Street. Tony Blair may be the first Prime Minister since the early Harold Wilson in 1964-66 not to chair the Senior Economic Committee of the Cabinet, now known as EA for Economic Affairs. The Chancellor chairs that, as he does the Public Expenditure Committee, PX, which is overseeing the comprehensive spending reviews, though here there's no change from the pattern as it was under John Major. From the early days, as a close observer put it, Brown and Blair were very much the joint drivers of New Labour. As you could say, Margaret Thatcher and Geoffrey Howe were of the Conservatives up to the 1981 budget. The difficulty for Whitehall is that no one else is very often is present at these meetings, and if they are, no minutes are taken. Even the most inner of Whitehall inner circles is not privy to what transpires, unless an element of collegiality is demanded by circumstances, as it was after the initial spinning of the press on the euro. Such a pattern, the key policy duopoly, if you like, is one way of tackling the verticality problem, and it has led to non-attributable descriptions of Brown as the chief policy executive to non-executive chairman Blair. Brown was quoted by one newspaper as envisaging his role as Prime Minister to President Blair, an absurd notion constitutionally. What is true is that Brown is a details man, and Blair is very much a Prime Minister for the big picture. Now, in some cases, a Cabinet Committee is the combatter of verticality. Brown's Welfare to Work Cabinet Committee, EAWW, may be one of these, though here there are several rivals, including the Department of Social Security's own reviews and a pair of task forces on tax and benefits and welfare to work. It will, I think, be a great test of the residual power of the Cabinet Secretariat to pull all this together. And in private, people reckon there are about five groups dealing with welfare to work, all of which have a Cabinet Office involvement. But the Cabinet Office have a trump card. Only ministers collectively can decide outcomes which involve competing and disputed options. It would be very surprising if final decisions in this area, welfare to work, followed the Formula One tobacco sponsorship model and went into number 10 for solo resolution. Number 10, however, is omnipresent in the serious policy reviews. A member of the 10 strong Downing Street policy unit sits on all the comprehensive expenditure review teams, as does a member of the Prime Minister's efficiency unit. And Mr. Blair has used his policy unit's briefs and his lawyer's interrogative skills to considerable advantage in his bilateral conversations with individual departmental ministers, perhaps more effectively and certainly less abrasively than Mrs. Thatcher's famous judge and jury sessions in number 10, which her ministers so disliked. Government by unit was very much a Thatcher phenomenon, but under Blair it has taken an interesting and maybe in terms of future patterns an important form. Keep an eye on the new social exclusion unit. It's run by the Cabinet Office's Economic Secretariat, though it reports directly to the Prime Minister. Five Whitehall departments are involved, but unusually so are representatives from business, local government and the police. It has 2 years of life initially, and if it makes a significant impact on this most difficult area, it could become the model for a new style Cabinet Office, driven as much by servicing such policy advising units as providing the Secretariat for more orthodox interdepartmental committees. But, ladies and gentlemen, at the heart of the picture I've been painting this evening lies a paradox. Here we have the most commanding of premiers, rivaled in the post-war period only by Mrs. Thatcher herself. The system is driven more from number 10 under Blair even than under her at her height. Yet alongside this, we see a refreshing experimentation of method, a wide array of approaches, not least the task forces drawing on outsiders. By August, there were more than 50 task forces, advisory groups and reviews at work when Caroline Daniel completed her map of the new geography of influence in the New Statesman. And the benefits, on top of all this, the benefits of the planned pre-legislative hearings in Parliament, not to mention those of the new freedom of information regime which will go into a draft bill next year, have yet to come into play. The head of a government which implements devolution to Scotland and Wales and incorporates the European Convention on Human Rights into domestic UK law cannot be convincingly portrayed as the elective dictator Lord Hailsham saw, a trifle absurdly in my view, when Labour Prime Ministers last occupied number 10. And yet, There are reasons for concern. The importance of being collective is not fully and properly appreciated in the Blair No. 10. This was apparent very early on in the government's life, when the Daily Mail got hold of a Prime Minister's personal minute on the subject of press handling. An interesting idea, Blair told his ministers, injected into the media, will be taken as a statement of government policy. All new ideas or statements of this sort must be cleared with number 10. All. This was not a marginal matter, given the degree to which the government, as one shrewd observer put it, was a message machine from the outset. No one has ever governed through the press like this, said a seasoned Whitehall figure of the number 10 operation run by Jonathan Powell and Blair's press secretary, Alistair Campbell. And we've seen the new unit set up last week, which is the instrument of this. Mrs. Thatcher's legendary Bernard Ingham, with whom I didn't always get on, we do not even now exchange Christmas cards, but even the legendary Bernard Ingham was sometimes offered as a model of restraint by comparison, not least by himself. It was not that number 10 was keen to keep its controls under wraps. When the ministerial code, Blair's updated version of questions of procedure for ministers, was published in July, there it was in black and white, in the now notorious paragraph 88, which represents the single most powerful piece of evidence for those who decry the creation of a control freak premiership. Under the heading Coordination of Government Policy, it reads, in order to ensure the effective presentation of government policy, all major interviews and media appearances, both print and broadcast, should be agreed with the number 10 press office before any commitments are entered into. The policy content of all major speeches, press releases, and new policy initiatives should be cleared in good time with the number 10 private office. The timing and the form of announcement should be cleared with the number 10 press office. Each department should keep a record of media contacts by both ministers and officials. Now, somebody who relished having leak inquiries done unto him in the 70s and early 80s and operated in a far more closed climate than now as a working journalist, the need to pass on a full record of those journalists with whom you have lunch is an extraordinarily interesting throwback. Now, within days of this going out, this ministerial code, of course, John Prescott made it known that he'd not cleared an important interview with The Observer with Alistair Campbell before doing it. And it was paragraph 88 above all, which led Peter Preston to conclude that any minister reading the ministerial code would feel a diminished, drivelling figure. And Peter Riddle was so moved by paragraph 88 as to declare, goodbye, Cabinet Government, welcome the Blair presidency. As he said, the document represented the biggest centralisation of power seen in Whitehall in peacetime. Amy Baker, whose authoritative study of the development of questions of procedure for ministers, a very peculiar process, will be published next year, says that in all the years since Attlee drew it up in something like its modern form, there's been nothing like it, even under Wilson's versions, which were quite restrictive. Whereas before ministers had to consult number 10, she says, before any public speeches were made, they now need also to consult number 10 on any new policy initiatives they come up with, which restricts their autonomy as a departmental minister. It may not be fully appreciated in Downing Street even now, but such an absolutist approach was neither desirable on constitutional grounds or realistic in practical terms. On one level, I suspect, it is becoming more appreciated as the weeks pass. A solo decision-taking centre, as the Formula One affair demonstrated, comes at a price. It may be quick and satisfying, but if it goes wrong, the buck stops with you. The blame cannot be shared unless the responsibility is genuinely collective. Also, once the policies agreed in opposition are worked through, legitimacy can only come and risk spread if there has been proper shared discussion before decision, which is a definition of cabinet government. This will be especially true when genuine public spending rounds return after the planned two-year link with the Conservatives' forward projections is at an end. Now, there are those, ladies and gentlemen, like the radical former Permanent Secretary Sir Peter Camp, who publicly applaud developments since May, not least because, as he puts it, all the things I've called for are coming true, a Prime Minister's department in all but name, and horizontality rather than verticality in policy making. There has indeed been serious talk at the heart of government about creating such a Prime Minister's department. And maybe it would be a post facto recognition of the reality that has emerged since the 2nd of May. And every Prime Minister since Wilson has considered creating an acknowledged Prime Minister's department at one point or another, only to reject the idea, rightly in my view. Why? Because ours, by tradition, is a collective, not a single, executive. Surely, as a political nation, we didn't struggle to replace the single executive represented by the 17th century sovereign by a more collective form of cabinet governments, only for it to mutate once more into an elected monarch. The powers of the British Prime Minister are so awesome, in relative terms, that we always need a sprinkler system around the occupant of number 10. My long-term solution would be to go for an avowed inner cabinet option. The Big Four plus Lord Irvine could become such a body, with a proper secretariat provided by the Cabinet Office and minutes circulated to the rest of the Cabinet. Let all the policy-making experimentation continue in the glory of its variable geometry. But we're not a solo pilot country. Napoleonic arrangements are not quite us. Events will make Tony Blair more collegial as his premiership deepens, especially if he wins a second term. But a necessary sense of the collective may take a while. At a dinner here at the LSE, 3 months before the government changed, I found myself next to a very substantial figure at the centre of one of the three great resignations of Mrs. Thatcher's premierships, and I'm not going to say whether it was Michael Heseltine, Nigel Lawson, or Geoffrey Howe. We talked about the coming Blair premiership, which we both expected, and agreed it would be on the command model. This would only store up trouble for him, I said. Yes, replied X, adding ruefully, but you can get away with it for a very long time. At the end of August, I was sufficiently concerned about the excessive and uncritical adulation of the new government, in the press especially, to write a piece in The Independent, in which I said, imitating Lady Bracknell again, it is always distressing to see serious, experienced people hurtling to the aid of the victors, as the French diplomat so aptly remarked of Italy in 1915. Tony Blair, I continued, needed the equivalent of the Monsignor who walks behind the Pope, flicking dust at the Pontiff and intoning Sic transit gloria mundi. And I translated this in a demotic style suitable for a rebranded Britain, ladies and gentlemen, as watch it, matey, you too are mortal. Now, I don't think the Prime Minister needs that Monsignor equivalent now. The tobacco sponsorship affair has taken care of that. And Mr. Blair was brave and gracious enough to admit a mistake. What we still need, however, as a mature political society, is for the Cabinet to assert its powers of collective discussion, not just occasionally, but routinely, Thursday in and Thursday out. For in the end, on such human checks and balances, against overmighty tendencies at the top, does the British system of government depend. Now, ladies and gentlemen, of course, if Mr. Blair were to walk into this hall this evening, he would disagree with both my analysis and my prescription, because he thinks he is running a system of cabinet government. In an interview with The Observer at the end of last month, he reacted strongly to suggestions that he was bypassing cabinet. To my certain knowledge, the Prime Minister declared, that has been said about virtually every administration in history that had a sense of direction. I remember that people said it back in the 80s about Thatcher. Of course you have to have cabinet government. I find that statement fascinating and unconvincing. Does it not occur to the Prime Minister that well-informed people spoke like that about Mrs. Thatcher in the 1980s because there was something in it? Has it also not occurred to him that you can have a powerful sense of direction as a government without facing accusations of personal overmightiness on the part of the Prime Minister? Does the ghost of Clem Attlee no longer stalk the passages of Number 10? Even with a Labour Prime Minister in residence. Now, the only kind of cabinet government Mr. Blair has seen at close hand is his own version. Those who've had close encounters with past Prime Ministers do think he's taking a highly prime ministerial approach towards administration. The forms of cabinet government may still be apparent, ladies and gentlemen, but the substance is not. And the sooner his cabinet ministers, the Downing Street collective as a whole, put that right, the better it will be for the government and for the country.
I think we now know why Peter was able to write a book, the title Sources Close to the Prime Minister. We have a little time available, and Peter has kindly agreed to take some questions. So I invite you to intervene.
Yes. David Walker's just praised and libelled the new Cabinet Secretary in equal measure. I repeat can I repeat it? Hasn't the choice of Sir Richard Wilson? What's that? Extraordinary. David? David, you're doing something. The director of GCHQ up there, he's got us wired up. Well, I don't mind speaking over a bit of interference, really. A bit of clutter never bothered me. David was saying, hasn't the choice of Sir Richard Wilson as Robin Butler's successor as Cabinet Secretary shown the double traits, as it were, because it's a traditional appointment, as it were, a traditional career civil service figure, who did you say has an incapacity to build that kind of centre? Yes. Well, we'll see, because in the end, Cabinet Secretaries have to do what they're asked to do. David and I have often had this discussion about Cabinet Secretaries, because we go to the Public Record Office together every December to see the new year releases, and last year we found the most wonderful piece of paper from Burke Trend to Harold Wilson, dated July the 19th, 1966, before the cabinet meeting that produced the big deflation, the big cuts, when everything went off the rails. And he said, you really can't go on like this. You need a cabinet committee that's serious on economic policy, which you have to chair, and never again must you bounce the cabinet into decisions of this magnitude without adequate warning or adequate data. With no caveats, wasn't it, David? It was a very direct piece of paper, and we wondered if indeed the style had perhaps changed of cabinet secretaries in the intervening years. So the point I'm making is that although cabinet secretaries are still grand figures, they are not quite the Norman Brook and Burke Trend figures that some in this room remember, who had a capacity to speak truth unto power when it was hugely inconvenient and not just get away with it but be respected for it. I don't think, although I'm not privy to all the steering briefs that the Cabinet Secretary has prepared for the Prime Minister in recent years by any means, that happens in quite that way now. So I think it is a different world anyway. But surely, if a Prime Minister wanted a Prime Minister's department, a Cabinet Secretary would so organise things that he got one, because they're not in the business of resigning. They are being in the business of being the Prime Minister's servant in the end, aren't they? Yes. David thinks we'd need a William Armstrong type of appointment to make it work, with perhaps a politically attuned, highly politically sensitive permanent secretary, if I can put it tastefully, to do it. But one of the problems is, I've always thought that if you mush up the division between the political and the permanent career civil service, you get into trouble, which is why the variable geometry has got to embrace an understanding that you don't want the senior civil service to become one of us in any sense, or be seen to be, or even thought to be that, because that's not what they're there for. If you want to put the political overlay on it, you pick particularly good special advisers to do that with you, and they work in fruitful symbiosis. I've always thought the British system was good at that, but I think there have been one or two problems since May the 2nd in one or two areas on that, and in one area in particular the problems have been acute, the Treasury. But one of the regrettable things since May the 2nd, I think, is that it's not proved that easy in some circumstances and some instances to keep those well-understood dividing lines as clear as they should be. Though, of course, in the day-to-day rush of events, everybody mucks in and works together. But it does seem to me that there's been a worrying blurring of lines there. It's as if some of the ministers who've come in believe what they read in The Guardian throughout the 1980s, that Mrs. Thatcher had indeed politicised the senior civil service, which I never thought she had, apart from two of them in number 10. I simply don't think that was true. And I don't know if the senior civil servants in the room want to comment on this, but I've always thought that permanent secretaries, by the time they were in their 50s, it was hard to get them to believe in anything, let alone a party manifesto, but I may be wrong about that.
If one talks about the cabinet system, for example, in Canada, they do have prime Thank you.
There's a good case to be made for it, Vernon, but I have a suspicion that those who want to create a Prime Minister's Department do it because they want it to be a personal instrument rather than a collective one. It usually comes up when they've got cross with the regular machine. Mrs. Thatcher started thinking seriously about a Prime Minister's Department after she thought the Foreign Office had let her down over the Falklands. Here we go again.
Can you just give yours a little bit of volume?
A bit of volume? Of course I will. It's very good, isn't it? I think they must be testing for the next lecture. I ought to act as a barker for my colleague Donald Sassoon, who's performing in the New Theatre at 7:30, I think. The Queen Mary and Westfield Department have come down in a charabanc. We're all here this evening. But I think they're probably getting ready for Donald, which would be nice. But no, that is the problem with it. It's usually, one usually suspects the motives of those that run with the Prime Minister's Department idea. And I'm not entirely convinced either that having a large number of people is necessarily a great advantage. Most people who've worked in Number 10 say that the small penumbra, provided it's very good, is an extremely efficient and effective way of doing it. And if you are operating a system of something approaching collegiality, you can use the other departments for information. And indeed, there was a thing called the Central Policy Review Staff, which I was very keen to see revived under this Prime Minister, but that would have been far too collective, wouldn't it, for the needs of Number 10 under the present incumbent. So I think the past has got certain models to offer for a strengthened centre without actually making it prime ministerial, unduly prime ministerial. But there again, Vernon, you've always been nicer about the political class than I have. Perhaps I am being too suspicious of their motives.
Well, Ben,
as someone who belongs to the Norman Brook generation, I find your analysis wholly convincing, but with the absence of one important contextual factor, and that is Parliament. I have no access to sources of information such as you enjoy. I only know what I see from the Peers' Gallery in the House of Commons once a week. And what I see is the drilled, what I call the Mandel clones. And it seems to me that a Prime Minister who can command that kind of obedience and support from a huge parliamentary majority, largely composed of novices, has it all his own way until, as you say, events prove otherwise.
Yes. I suppose the Duke of Wellington would call them the finest brute votes in Europe, wouldn't he? But the select committees have started doing what they should do. They were hugely inconvenient for the Prime Minister last week on the health business. And they are our best hope, I think, on this front. I think the majority of 179 is regrettable, really. It doesn't do anybody any good, that size. But there again, under our first past the post, you do get these extraordinary shifts in terms of a winner's bonus of seats, don't you? But I do worry about the parliamentary end, and the reason I've not mentioned them, Max, is until last week they didn't seem to figure in anybody's calculations at all. But they also seem to be getting quite upset about the lack of power they've got, that those who had experience in local government are discovering, as everybody who's had experience in local government who becomes a member of parliament, that it's a deeply depressing experience because you've nothing to do and no influence on anybody. And in the end, with a bit of luck, some of them will acquire a degree of fibre. I agree with you, an injection of water would stiffen their backbones at the moment. No, I'm not actually, but it's interesting that you should think that I was saying that, actually.
Whether it will work, and how long it will work,
it can't work, can it? It can't work. But I actually think I always rather wish that he'd spoken more to Jim Callaghan before he entered the Premiership, because Jim gets rather a bad press these days, had very difficult circumstances to deal with. But where Jim, I think, was an exceedingly effective Prime Minister, with no majority, it went on the first day, he was in number 10, full day, worked in number 10, and we all remember the economic background. Was Jim, I mean, I don't want to paint him as some kind of hero, and we all know that he could be extremely brutal with ministers, very brusque and so on, but he actually practiced the collective style whenever he could, and had credit in the bank when he had to move really rather carefully and quickly with just a small group, or when he kept one or two issues, uncapping Stirling and all that, and the nuclear question, away from the full cabinet. I think the Shrewd's prime ministers operate twin track, and they're as collegial as they can be, as often as they can be, which means that they can get away with it in that sense, politically, with their colleagues when they do have to take shortcuts. But the problem people do forget, I mean, remember Mrs. Thatcher's last words? I had a sense I was losing the cabinet, and every prime minister knows they can't go on if they lose the cabinet. And John Biffin, remember, she thought she was a tigress surrounded by hamsters. And he called it the revenge of the unburied dead, you know, the backbenchers. The people she'd sacked, the unburied dead, and the hamsters required these dentures. You see, just got her, didn't they? Now, that any shrewd prime minister should know that for a long time, the patronage society means that you can keep them in line. They're so grateful to be there, so grateful to you. You've boosted the majority. And, of course, you know, Enoch Powell's wonderful image in cabinet sitting next to Harold Macmillan, although he wasn't next to Harold, he was hidden away behind the cabinet secretary because Harold couldn't stand his eyes, do you remember? It was like having a conversation with Henry VIII, the axe is by the chair. Now, one of the least pleasing factors of this government is at least two cabinet ministers have had the axe sharpened from about day two. They've been fingered for the reshuffle, and it's driving one of them slightly distracted at probably both of them. And I think that's a terrible way of running a government. But you get to a certain point in the life of any administration, if events hit you, that the majority is, there's no protection. As Harold found, with a majority of 97 in March 66, it didn't help him with the money markets in July 66, did it? And also you get to the point where a proportion of the cabinet become unsackable for one reason or another. And they get in a sense of their own worth. They realise, as George Jones has always said, that statutes put functions and money into the hands of secretaries of state, not the prime minister. And in the shadow cabinet days, they were told nothing. They were used to this way of being treated. But they might suddenly acquire a sense of their own worth. And I think they will. So it's not so much a ratchet effect. I think it does oscillate on the spectrum. But shrewd prime ministers can operate the twin track, and indeed should operate the twin track. But I don't see a ratchet effect, actually. I really don't. And then it's less alarming. Oh, yes, I think... I don't want to see like Adam Smith's invisible hand, but the British system does have a peculiar way of writing itself, partly because nobody knows what the British system is.
Someone who knew nothing about cabinet government whatever, like Lord Russell, has this distinguished between two centres of power, and I used to argue with John Mackintosh that he's got a rather confused in the cabinet government. And it certainly would say his power and unchallengeability, and his power and the ability to carry out the premeditated intention.
Yes. Added to what Bernard said about the nature of power is one always has to remember under the British system the most powerful people can suddenly in a very short space of time be gone. And Mrs. Thatcher didn't have an easy year in 1990, but nobody, as they came back for the autumn season, political season in 1990, thought she'd be gone by the end of the calendar year. And I was in the United States when it happened. They simply couldn't believe it. I said it doesn't happen very often, 1940, 1916, and so on. And it was remarkable, the speed and brutality with which that happened. And by long arrangement, I'd arranged to give a lecture in Washington, been asked to do one, and I gave the title 12 months earlier, Mrs. Thatcher's History. And I got up. I got up the day she went, and I said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I tried to think of something to make it more interesting, pulling the crowd a bit. You may think I've gone too far." They were absolutely amazed. They couldn't understand how we can do it. And they are so weak and so powerful all in one. Because of, well, many of the reasons of which Bernard has just spoken. So we always have to remember that, and of course there's an element of seeing rivals. Wilson's line about, as long as there's more than one crown prince, my own head is secure. I mean, Ben brought that out brilliantly in the biography. It was a constant obsession with that. But there's no problem with that at the moment. One of the problems I do think is I think the Prime Minister has borrowed the Labour Party. I don't think it's his. And I think when things do go wrong and they play up, and they are very awkward, the Labour movement, they're really extremely difficult people. I mean, fond of them I am. He'll get very cross with them and very impatient, you know. And Jim and Harold, for all their faults, had this genius for accumulating balances, and the debts could be called in when the going got rough, which it always did. There wasn't one bit of the Labour movement that they didn't understand. I mean, Jim in particular. And I've quoted it before. I remember saying to an old Labour, well, original Labour figure, just before the election, that I felt uneasy, because for the first time in my life, I felt I was somewhat to the left of the leader of the Labour Party. And that I had more roots in the Labour movement than he did. And he said, "Tony's roots in the Labour movement are comparable to those of a stick of celery," he said. And I think that's true, and I think that's going to be a severe problem, because Max Ray's Parliament, you can carry on as if none of these factors there don't apply to you. It's me and I'm different syndrome, but it's not like that. The British system has a habit of coming up and catching you by the gonads when you least expect it, and it will happen to this one, as it's happened to nearly every other Prime Minister in our lifetime, he predicted. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Gene has just said how already he's used up one of his 9 lives just for £1 million on Formula One and so on, and that it's bound to get more collegiate. I'm absolutely right, but what worries me, you see, is that they get very upset if anybody crosses them. They're very sensitive to press criticism in the way that Major was. Major couldn't walk past a first edition of a newspaper in number 10 at 11:30 at night without picking it up, and he'd get upset. If you read Anthony Seldon's new biography of Major, one of the saddest bits is it wasn't just getting upset with the first editions. When he got the first edition of the Evening Standard, if it was unkind to him, he'd be upset for the whole afternoon. It's extraordinary how sensitive they are. But this lot are terribly upset, and the first breath of criticism they get on the phone, you know, it's very funny that they should be like that. The only saving grace of the British political class for years has been its self-irony, and I detect a distinct lack of that. So I am worried about them, because they will be terribly upset when it goes wrong. Give me no pleasure to say I told you so, but of course I will say that, which will annoy me. Yes. Ken?
Yes.
Is it Ken?
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
Charles, yes. 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 The problem with number 10 running too much of the press and being suspected, rightly or wrongly, of leaking things, not least against individual ministerial interests, is it's deeply, deeply corrosive. And Bernard Ingham wasn't quite as bad as I tended to paint him. Not quite. But on the occasions when he did this, it was hugely counterproductive and resented by many ministers. And if you have somebody who is not elected, I mean, again, it's very interesting how overmightiness in general terms is a problem. It's not always just overmightiness on the part of the Prime Minister the problem, but the entourage, the number 10 private office. I think Lord Irvine is already, poor chap, finding this resentment because he's not an elected person. And he arrived quite late in the House of Lords. I mean, we have people from the House of Lords here. I don't think he has found a particularly warm reception in the House of Lords. And when you make a sort of, quotes, light-hearted remark comparing yourself to Wolsey and saying there's never been a Lord Chancellor like me, I mean, and also the Chancellor of the Exchequer is causing all sorts of resentment because he thinks he's running all the policies, particularly in the social policy area, because he's got the money tap. And so what you're getting, Charles, is not just the resentments building up against the centre, but against other bits of the constellation, not quite all of it, but a lot of it. And this isn't the way to conduct central government. It's not a kind of adventure playground for those who seek catharsis after being in opposition for 18 years. It's serious. And you can't go on behaving as you did in opposition, where you leak strategically against your rivals in the shadow cabinet. And that's what will start, you see. There will be countermeasures from individual secretaries of state using tame lobby correspondence to leak against the middle. And never forget, I shouldn't say this, those of you who've been journalists like Peter Rose will know this, that the best leaks always come motivated by a Scheidenfreude. It's a department that's not in the manure, but knows the full detail, which it doesn't like, that is in the manure, that gives you everything. I remember when I used to cover the Civil Service Department, I can say this now because it's gone, it was always departments that thought they knew how to manage things, unlike those XYZs in the CSD, that would leak systematically against what the poor Civil Service Department was trying to do. And it won't be long before we get that. And so the problem will be compounded. I don't know why we should be shocked, actually, because it's always been thus. It's just, I suppose, that I'm being faintly acid about it all because of this absurd adulation of this lot. You think there's a step change? You think it's really... Yeah. Well, we have the biographer of Herbert Morrison at the back. George, what do you think? Has it changed? Oh, you can't hear. Yeah. Well, Charles is saying that the spinning of the press and the leaking and the management of it has got exponentially worse. Yes. I thought it did. I had a feeling you'd say that, George.
Time for one last question and story, Ken Morgan.
Oh, yes. Well, the bit that does worry me is you hear occasionally from ministers that they think once the concordats are drawn up by the Cabinet Office for dealing with Scotland and all that, it's all over. You don't have to worry about that, but you can get on with that. Well, it's just the beginning, isn't it? It's going to be a rolling conversation and a rolling adjustment. Built in, absolutely. So I don't want to sound as if I'm putting on the white coat. I'm not one of nature's social workers, but I do worry about them, Ken. You're quite right.
I think the applause indicates how excellent a lecture you've given, and certainly I think the most entertaining in our series. Thank you very much.